If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/acast. That's burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Hello and welcome to the Hort Week podcast. I'm Hort Week editor Matthew Appleby, and today I'm with Bluebell Cottage Gardens and Nursery owner Sue Beasley. So, welcome, Sue.
Hello, Matt.
And now, you've got gardens, you've got a retail nursery, you've got a cafe, all in Cheshire. So how do you manage it all?
Well, I guess I'm used to running sort of, in the IT business I was in before, I sort of looked after every aspect of the business except for making the technology work. And yeah, I guess I'm a natural multitasker. And if I haven't got lots of interesting and different things to do, I get a bit bored. So it's right up my street.
Excellent. So your background, you worked in IT for many years, but you've been a horticulturist for many years too.
Yes. I came into horticulture as a complete amateur, aged 45. I think one of the great things about horticulture is it's a fabulous industry for people to come into as a second, third, or even fourth career. And very briefly, I met Beth Chatto once in my very first year that I started the nursery. And she looked over her glasses and said, "Isn't it wonderful to see young people coming into horticulture?" And of course, at that point, I felt like a dinosaur. So, yeah, what a great place to be.
That's very flattering. Oh, well, what a great mentor.
Yeah.
So you grow 700 different perennials and propagate them too. So that's a lot of different plants. So which are the ones which you like growing best? Which ones sell best and grow best and do best for you?
Well, it keeps changing over the years. To start with, I just carried on growing the hardy perennials that the original nursery, because I bought the nursery in 2007. So initially I just carried on, but then some things didn't sell, some things didn't grow very well. So each year we sort of dropped some and carried some forward with a view to really just trying to refine what makes an absolutely brilliant garden plant for anyone. And so sort of 80 to 90% of the plants that we grow here are just good, solid, hardy varieties that are tried and trusted and grow well in the garden here. We're in Cheshire, so it's in the northern half of the country, but we're on a nice sandy south-facing slope. So it's quite a good test of whether a plant's hardy or not. We do get cold winters, but we're not as exposed as some places. So we're just trying to nail down what we think are cracking plants. At the moment, the plants that are really shining are asters in the garden. Little Carlo just looks stunning. It's an old plant, it's been going for years, but it just looks fantastic and is very easy to grow. So that's our sweet spot, I think.
Brilliant. Now, you obviously sell from the nursery, but also mail order and shows.
Yes.
So how does that mix work for you? What's the proportions and what's growing and falling in that area?
Yes. So the visitors to the nursery obviously dipped in the pandemic, and that was, a, with hindsight, a phenomenally interesting research opportunity for many businesses, myself included. I think without the garden to visit, the nursery as a standalone place to come in and buy plants probably wouldn't be viable. Well, you know, we're off a main road, you've got to come and find us. But so the combination of having a reason to visit, which is frankly to have a nice time, wander around the gardens, have a cup of tea and a slice of cake, and then people start to build confidence in the plants because they've seen them in the garden. So actually the trio of the nursery that's open, the gardens and the tea room acts as an integrated whole for us. The online side became inevitable, frankly, and because of my IT background, I was relatively confident with the specification of that, and that's worked very well. And the shows, it's a lot of PR. You know, it's massively hard work going along to a show and building the displays and keeping all the stock back to build the display with and learning the art and the craft of it. But the PR is fabulous, particularly once you start to get good gold medals. And increasingly now we get visitors coming in, and even before they've looked round, the first thing they ask is, are you going to be at Tatton? And it definitely, it excites people, the thought that they're going to see us at the shows, and it's great for sales and good for PR too.
No, well, you're big on social media as well, which I guess must be good for PR, but why do you go so big on social media? What does it do for you professionally, do you think?
Well, it has changed over the years. My first introduction to Twitter was as a deeply reluctant gardener who just didn't see the point. But a PR company that Cheshire Gardens were working with at the time persuaded me, and I reluctantly let them set up at Sue Beasley as a Twitter account, which, oh, I'm so grateful that they did that for me. And I found that very quickly, horticultural journalists were using Twitter as a place to find stories and find people. And Cheshire's hardly the back and beyond, but I think the critical mass of horticulture is set, you know, there's a lot of it in the southeast. And Twitter for me was a way of engaging with both a gardening audience online, but critically actually with the media. And I don't know what to extent that's still the case, but I find out so much. You know, I do post a bit on Twitter, but it's been a wonderful source of information and ideas and leads and introductions to people, and a way of chatting to the wider garden community. That is changing, and I'm still there. I'm waiting for someone to invite me to Blue Sky. But apparently you need an access code and I haven't got one yet. Facebook, I think, is wonderful for engaging with your immediate customers and direct followers. But I think to a certain extent, we're all still waiting to see what will replace the marvel that has been Twitter.
Ah, interesting. How do you find time to do it all? Because you've got, like, juggling quite a few things there with the nursery and the shows, the cafe, you know, the social media, the, you know, the marketing. You know, all nursery people are sort of have to sort of be jacks of all trades. But how do you find the time?
Well, I delegate, and I know that that's perhaps for me that's a completely normal and natural thing to do. Once I know how to do something well, frankly, I would rather show somebody else how to do it and let them crack on and become better than I could ever be at it. Because I always want to sort of think about what's new and what's next. So that is my instinct. So maybe there's that. The tea room, I go in, make myself a brew, see if there's any spare bits of cake and walk out again. I leave that to lovely Jess to run. And increasingly, I'm not stepped away from the nursery at all, but in terms of practical day-to-day work, I went in this morning to the girls, and we tipped out three great big pots of Ophir Pogon. I did the first couple of divisions, showed them how to do it. They're dead happy. I've walked away, left them to it, and come in to chat to you. And that for me is actually how you run a business, and it always has been. I love it watching people get quicker and faster than me, and it's great. So that's one answer is actually learn when to step back.
Delegation. No, I like it. No, now, just before we were talking, before we started this, about barriers to expansion, and that's an area you're sort of interested in. It is an area in British horticulture which is an issue. So what do you think the barriers to expansion are?
Well, I think the many. I think the Brexit decision, I think, was followed by an awful lot of people saying, oh, well, you know, it'll just be fine. We'll just expand horticultural production in the UK. And the initial difficulties or the potential difficulties of importing will just be dealt with by that. But, you know, lots of other businesses, if you want to start a business, you can go along and look for retail premises to rent or office premises or industrial units to let, and you just get on and you crack on. But horticulture is different. You need land and you need structures. And land is expensive and under huge competition for potential other purposes. I give you a classic example. I was trying to bid to buy 10 acres of land, and I was outbid by a guy who wanted to run an electric, not a scooter park, you know, one of these like track day type things. And then there's obviously property and people holding land in case it goes for planning at some point. So first of all, there's availability of suitable land and the cost of it. And even if you get over that hurdle, you've got planning permission over polytunnels and structures. Well, that's not a given. It can take a long time. So there's that fundamental. We have not embraced horticulture as a great land use in the UK in the way that our northern European cousins have done over the last few decades. Because we were one great trading unit, we let the Dutch crack on with it and effectively outsourced horticultural production to them in large measure. Second one, I think, is when I first took over this nursery, I was a student at Rees Heath College, and I went to ask my then horticultural lecturer, well, kind of, where's the manual? How do I do this? Where's the how to run a nursery book that I've obviously missed on the shelf? And my lecturer then, Harry Delaney, who I'm sure some of your listeners will know of by personally, if not by repute, sort of scratched his head and he said, well, you know, where you know, love, it's not quite like that. It's kind of handed down. You know, each nursery is different, and to kind of learn down the generations. And that's, if you think about it, it's extraordinarily true. If you walk around the shows and you look at many of the exhibits, an awful lot of them are second generation or even third. And the how-to of growing is so often acquired through experience and family know-how. So there's a lot of that. A lot of that knowledge is just embedded in that. And I think the third thing for me is it's horticulture, essentially. There's very low recognition of it as a professional skill. It's still in large areas considered to be, you know, mowing and blowing and, you know, deadheading or whatever. And but as a horticulturalist, you're thinking every day, what's up with this plant? How do I do this? And that accumulated and learned skill is seriously undervalued. So I think those are the three big issues for me.
No, indeed. So do you have plans to expand?
I did have. About 3 or 4 years ago, I had plans to really try to build what I felt was missing in certainly in the northern half of the UK, which was a cracking wholesale nursery of good hardy perennials. And there's huge capacity missing from the UK market in that arena. But I don't have deep enough pockets, and I've been there in terms of running businesses and taking those big risks and short of a really big partner to do it with. And I'm 62, which is dead young, I know. But I think that moment may have passed. What I am doing is really trying to work hard on the land I've got. We've just expanded, cleared a massive area of brambles, levelled it. It's much bigger than I thought. And I think that should give us capacity to grow about another 30,000 plants a year, which is a nice big increase for us, but it's not a drop, frankly, in terms of what the UK, I think, could grow and should grow if we could just get past those barriers.
No, that's great news. And you do have developments happening. Like you're very keen on solar PV and heat pumps, and you're big on promoting them. So how did you get into that?
I kind of can't remember a time when I haven't been interested, if I'm absolutely honest with you. It's very deep, long beginnings. I did an Open University degree in my 30s, and one of the modules I was itching to do was renewable energy, with no thought any at all at the time that I would do any of this. But then when solar PV had a brief flurry of investment through the feed-in tariffs in the early, I put mine in 2011. And Matthew, it's a complete no-brainer. If you've got southeast or west-facing roof, everybody I know who's put them up has looked at the electricity production and consumption and just been astonished. Most people who haven't got them think, oh, well, you know, it'll generate maybe 10, 15, 20% of what I need on a sunny day. The answer is, on a sunny day in Cheshire, the panels on the front of my house, which are now 12 years old, and it's just an ordinary house, generate between 120 and 200% of what my house uses on a daily daily basis. Now, clearly in winter, it's a lot lower. But from March to September, we buy a bit from the grid, but my standing charge is higher than my electric bill. And I think people just need to see it and see the numbers and look at it. And, you know, my daughter's put them on, my neighbours, everybody that's come around here and seen the panels and seen the figures, seen the data for real, just kind of walks away and says, yeah, I'm having that. And it's so much cheaper now. When I first put my panels up, electricity was a quarter the price it is now, and the panels were double the price. So if it's an eightfold improvement in the economics, and it's great.
That sounds pretty convincing. And what about the heat pumps? Yeah. How did you get into that?
Well, I got into that because my solar panels produced me a surplus for most of the year. And because of that, I put a couple of batteries in. And then I quickly realised that although the batteries are fantastic for storing my surplus solar, in the winter, you can buy cheap rate electricity at night and stuff them in your batteries and then use them all day. So my cost of electricity overall is just through the floor. Compared to, we're talking an ordinary three-bedroom house here with a garage on the side. It really is not anything special. So from the solar PV came the batteries, and then from there thinking, well, hang on a minute, my oil boiler is noisy, it's smelly, it's fossil fuels. What can I do to maybe get rid of this? So I've been following the heat pump debate closely for a good 18 months or so, and I'm a Telegraph subscriber. I read all the negative stories that are being pumped out every day. So it's not like I'm completely naive. But then I just thought, no, I'm going to pursue this. And if I want to pull out, I can pull out. But it's in, it's commissioned, it's working. And one thing I've really learned is we take so much for granted about the way we currently do things. And then when somebody challenges that, everybody gets panicky. But here's a thought for you. In order to heat our houses to 21 degrees, we heat water using an oil boiler or gas to 50 or 60 degrees. And then we pump that round and then we turn it on or off, depending on where the house temperature is. What a heat pump system says is, right, so you want your house at 20 degrees. So I think 30 might do. So let's pump hot water around at 30 degrees. And it takes a little bit longer, but then you get there. And then it sits there very nicely, just chugging 30 degree water around your radiators. And you touch the radiators and they don't feel warm. But that's because our body temperatures are 37 degrees. So you have this period of self-doubt, but then you look at your room temperature and it's warm and you realize it's just maintaining this nice evenness. And it's a different way of thinking, but it works brilliantly.
Well, that's very innovative, and hopefully it's an inspiration to other growers. Now, there is another string to your bow as well, which is your work with the RHS at Bridgewater, and now on the herbaceous plant committee vice chair, and also now on the council from this year, and you've just had your first meeting. So what's that like?
Oh, it's seriously exciting, I tell you. I run a small business now in Bluebell. It's lovely, it's divine. I love the people, I love the plants, but I do have, I think, capacity to do a bit more, and I've got the time to give a bit more back. I was just asked if I would help with the GM trial, and then one thing led to another. And last year I got a call to see if I would apply to go on the RHS Council. And they were looking to strengthen the horticultural membership. But I think the fact that my business background is there as well kind of added to that. You know, when my application was approved, they said, we see you as an all-rounder. And I think that's what I'm trying to bring, is that connection between horticulture and business and sustainability, and hopefully come at it from a multidimensional point of view. And clearly the contents of the council meeting are confidential, but I can tell you I'm seriously impressed, not just with the calibre of people sitting around that council table, the mix of expertise that they've got, the breadth and the depth, but with the way it's run. Keith Weed is the relatively new president. A couple of people said to me, how are you going to cope? You know, organisations like this, it's all very slow. Meetings take for hours. Oh, no. It's sharp. It's well managed. The papers are presented. It's assumed that you've read them. The meetings are crisply and well managed. And I think it's fantastic, and I'm there for the long haul if they'll have me.
Oh, brilliant news. And you're doing a lot with Bridgewater as well. So
yeah.
How are you enjoying Bridgewater developing?
Well, first of all, for years, other northern growers and gardens and I have been saying that the Northwest deserves and ought to have its own garden. So I didn't know it was coming. It was a fantastically well-kept secret, as it should have been. But the first I heard, I was so excited. And then they asked me if I would join the advisory panel, partly really to bring a northern... I'm not a northern, I grew up in the southeast, but I've been up here 30 years and grown for 20. So I think they wanted that experience of growing in the northwest to bring. And I could not be more proud and more excited and more thrilled about what Bridgewater is, what it brings to the Northwest. And I know it will just continue to act as a kind of foundation and a pivotal central point for horticultural expertise and growth in the Northwest. It's a massive privilege to be part of it. Like anything else, it's at an early stage. People will have things to say about what it should or shouldn't have or shouldn't do. Hey, look, we're 2 years into a 100-year journey here. Get stuck in, let's enjoy it and join the journey.
Oh, brilliant. Now, it's autumn and you close for the winter, so is that a nice break for you? Do you have plans to open longer or shorter even?
Yeah, well, I have shortened my hours, actually. We used to open Sundays as well. We now open Wednesday to Saturday. No, I don't want to open in the winter. I know it's a logical progression for some, but because of where we are, we're down a narrow lane on the wrong side of a canal bridge, and the nursery freezes. It's cold in winter, and herbaceous perennials, there's not much to see. So actual footfall visitors, I'm very happy that we close. It gives us time to do projects, rip things apart, get that broken polytunnel repaired. And I think for me, what we've tried to do is build shoulder activities so that the online shop helps to widen the season for us. Increasingly, we're supplying landscapers, garden designers around the UK. That's been fabulous. And for me, it is a mental break, but I do spots of writing and gives me a bit more time for my RHS work as well. So it all hangs together.
Just going on to our final question. Is there a particular plant which is your favourite? One which you'd take to a desert island?
Oh, a desert island plant. That's a challenge. Tempted to go for a small tree like Cornuscusa or something wonderfully productive like a quince. But no, I'm going to stick with a perennial and I'm going to go with Dianthus carthusianorum. Wonderful, you know, bright pink sparkles. It'll love being on a desert island with all that well-drained soil. And importantly, it comes true from seed. I do love a plant that I can propagate myself. So, yeah, Dianthus carthusianorum would be my desert island choice.
Great. Well, thanks a lot for all that, Sue. I'll let you get back to your multitude of tasks, as I'm sure are building up. But superb. No, it's been great talking to you. It's been fascinating insight into your business and life. And this has been the Hawk Week podcast. Make sure you never miss a Hawk Week podcast. Subscribe to or follow Hawk Week podcasts via Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Google Podcasts, or your preferred podcast platform. And once again, thanks to Sue Beasley. I'm Matt Appleby from Hawk Week, and goodbye until next time.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Kayla Itzinas.
I'm Kayla Itzinas, and I have been training a global community of women since 2009. I've created a brand new podcast, Sweat Daily, to help you level up your life and reach your health and well-being goals. From fitness tips to food that fuels you, meditation to motivation, we've got you covered. Sweat Daily, the happiest, healthiest, and most confident version of you awaits. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.